Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is Sports Takeover with Matt and Chris, and you are listening to RMU Radio. We have lots to talk about, so let's get to it. Starting in the National Football League, where the season has just concluded, Super Bowl 54 is in the books, and the Kansas City Chiefs are Super Bowl champions.
And they did it in the same style that they won each of their other two playoff games in. Went down, let the other team take a lead, get a little bit comfortable, and then stormed right back. Final score was 31-20 in favor of Kansas City. The score doesn't really tell the whole story of the game, though. It was 10-10 at halftime. First half was pretty close, I would say, both sides of the ball. Fairly even. Not a whole lot going on, just kind of feeling out. Then by the end of the third quarter, Niners stormed ahead. It was 20-10. They were 15 minutes away from winning their sixth Super Bowl, tying the Patriots and the Steelers. And Patrick Mahomes said, well, no, that's okay. As they put up 21 points in the last 9 minutes of the fourth quarter to come away with the 11-point victory.
Yeah, so that clinches their first championship in 50 years, second in franchise history. Patrick Mahomes, who was named Super Bowl MVP, 26 of 42, 286 yards, pair of touchdowns, a pair of interceptions, also added a rushing touchdown. He was good late. I don't think he deserved to be the MVP.
No.
I think the MVP should have been Williams, the running back.
Yes.
17 carries, 104 yards with a touchdown, four receptions, 29 yards, and a touchdown receiving as well. Obviously led the charge in those 21 points that they scored late in the fourth quarter to win the game. To me, it should have been him. Mahomes only really looked like the Patrick Mahomes that we've come to expect in the last nine minutes, something like that. Everything prior to that was less than spectacular. A couple other standouts, Tyreek Hill, 9 receptions for 105 yards, Sammy Watkins, 5 for 98. Travis Kelce 6 for 43 and a touchdown. Breland and Fuller each had an interception. It was really a balanced team win all across the board. I mean, I don't think you can make a case for a lot of guys to potentially be the MVP. I don't think there's any clear cut player, and I think that's why it went to Mahomes. For Coach Andy Reid, that's win number 222, Super Bowl number 2, first as a head coach. He won as an assistant coach before, but this is the first one that really gets credited to him, and he absolutely deserves all that credit.
I was looking at all of his year-by-year coaching records and stuff. He's 61 now. He's been – I didn't realize he was so
old. Been around a couple times.
He's looked like he's been the same age for the last 15 years. But, I mean, he's been a very good head coach for long enough that he deserves a Super Bowl. Was with the Eagles in 04 whenever they lost to the Patriots in that one. Hasn't been back since. Finally gets his win. In all 21 years he's coached, too, he's only had 3 losing seasons. His first with the Eagles, his last with the Eagles, and then one right in the middle with the Eagles. So – a very good record for him, a very well-deserving Super Bowl victory for him. And on the other side of the ball, it's Kyle Shanahan once again at the hands of so close but not quite there, because when he was with the Falcons as their offensive coordinator, they blew the infamous 28-3 lead against the Patriots, and we all know how that legend will never die as it stands. And he's now the head coach of the Niners, and once again, just can't get the job done. But I don't think it's as much of his fault this time. I think last in the Falcons Super Bowl, the play calling kind of went south and they kind of started playing passively instead of playing the football that got them to the victory. Whereas here, I don't think the Niners were exactly having bad play calls. I think they just weren't executing them. I mean, Garoppolo didn't really look, he looked bad. He was 20 for 31, which is okay. 219 yards, 1 touchdown, 2 interceptions, but a lot of those were checkdowns or screens or 5-yard passes. It was really a Devlin Hodges-type performance. Nothing really stood out. There wasn't any 20-yard bombs downfield or big plays left and right. I mean, George Kittle had the one big reception at the end of the first half, but other than that, there was not that big connection we'd seen all year between them. So the important players need to step up in the fourth quarter. Mahomes did, Garoppolo didn't.
Well, and of course, that play that you're referencing at the end of the first half didn't even count. It got called back on offensive
pass interference,
so that didn't even stand. It's kind of a similar story for the Niners as it was to the Chiefs in terms of it being a pretty balanced team type of game. Unfortunately, they just didn't quite have the play at the level that the Chiefs did. You mentioned Garoppolo's stat line. Mostert, who of course went off in the NFC title game, came out for 12 carries, 58 yards, and a touchdown. Fine. It's okay.
It's not what they
but
build their
not,
team on.
No, it's not. When you're a run-based team, that's not going to get the job done. Deebo Samuel, 5 catches for 39 yards, 3 carries for 53 yards. So they kind of use him in some big play moments, but obviously not quite the explosiveness of the big play downfield, like you mentioned. Kendrick Bourne, 2 receptions for 42 yards. That was the most receiving yards of any wide receiver.
And he's like their third or fourth string, too. It's not
right.
Sanders. It's not Deebo. Well, Deebo did have a good game, though.
Yeah, Deebo played well. But as far as receiving yards go, it was Bourne. And then Kyle Hughescheck, the fullback, had the touchdown. 3 receptions, 39 yards, and a touchdown for him. honestly, at one point, it looked like he could have been the Super Bowl MVP.
He almost had a second touchdown.
Pulled things off, yeah. Jaquaski Tartt, Nick Bosa each had a sack. DeForest Buckner had a sack and a half. So they did get to Mahomes some. It just wasn't quite enough. And I think we talked about that, or I know I definitely talked about that on the show last week, about how the key was going to be getting to Patrick Mahomes. And they were able to for most of the game, but then at the end, they weren't able to. And part of that comes on the offense not being on the field, not running down any clock. The defense is spending a lot of time out there, and the Chiefs strike quickly.
Yeah, and like I made a big point last week, Sherman's a good cover corner, but not really good man-to-man. Well, Tyreek Hill torched him, 9 yards, or 9 receptions, 105 yards. I really didn't hear Sherman's name at all on the whole broadcast, other than, yeah, you know, Sherman's out there, don't forget he's out there, but he was non-impactful whatsoever in the grand course of the game. The Chiefs all season, a pass-first team, not really built on running. They had 2 games this year where they had a rusher have over 100 yards. It was against the Vikings. In that game, Patrick Mahomes was not playing, so they kind of relied more on Damian Williams. And then week 17 against the Chargers, when it didn't really make that much of a difference that week either, Williams had 100 yards. So only twice throughout the whole season, including the postseason, did they have a 100-yard rusher until the Super Bowl when they had their third. And, I mean, they beat the Niners at the Niners' own game, essentially. The Niners set the tone all the time by running. But when your leading rusher has 58 yards coming off of a 220-yard performance, it's not going to get the job done for you.
Credit to the Kansas City defense for finding a way to shut down not only Derrick Henry in the AFC title game, but then Raheem Mostert, who was playing very well coming into the Super Bowl.
And they shut down Lamar Jackson way back earlier in the season, big rushing attack on the Ravens. Maybe they have a good idea of how to stop the good running backs. They just can't figure out how to get the middle ground ones.
Maybe. Hey, it's good coaching. Andy Reid certainly knows how to get the job done. There is one thing, though, that I want to talk about with the Super Bowl, and that's the last 2 minutes of the first half, because I think it was handled very poorly. The 49ers get the stop with about a minute 45 left. They were just on the other side of the two-minute warning. They had all 3 timeouts. They don't take one as they get the stop. I'm fine with that. I can live with that. You get the ball back. Some time runs off the clock. If you don't make anything happen offensively, you punt it back to them with less time on the clock. I'm fine with that. What I'm not fine with is after you receive the ball, you come out running and not taking timeouts. Content to go to halftime when you've got a little bit over a minute and 3 timeouts to work with and an offense that isn't explosive, but they can certainly put together a minute-long drive with Absolutely. 3 timeouts at their disposal. So that's the first thing, is that they come out not interested in apparently breaking the 10-10 tie. Then the Chiefs decide, I think this was after second down, they call a timeout.
Yeah, after second down.
They call a timeout because in their eyes, the Niners aren't trying to get a first down. We're going to get the ball back. Sure. Let's have some extra time.
Absolutely.
Which I think is the wrong decision. If you're the Chiefs and you punt that ball away with a minute, a little bit over a minute, to me, if the 49ers come out and don't do anything, you should take that as a win and get out of there. Like, to me, it's already a win that they aren't trying to press you, because then on the other side of that Chiefs timeout, the 49ers take a shot downfield to George Kittle, as you referenced earlier, and an offensive pass interference call that was maybe a little bit iffy would have put the 49ers in field goal range with time and timeouts to work with. Not a lot of time, but enough that they definitely probably would have broken that 10-10 tie. So first of all, the Niners mishandle that. Then the Chiefs almost give them a redo after mishandling it. Just kind of a mess. To me, if you're the Niners, come out aggressive. You're trying to win the Super Bowl. Even if you only go down there and you get a field goal, it's 13-10. That changes things a little bit. So I don't know why they didn't choose to go for it in any sense of the word. And on the Chiefs side, take your win. The Niners came out, had timeouts, and chose not to use it. Take the win and go to halftime.
So here's the thing with the Niners for me. They should have taken the timeout immediately. There's no you're okay with them not taking it. Whenever they got the ball back, they need to take the timeout. Since they decided to run the ball immediately, you take the timeout because your run, they can break off 20-yard runs here and there.
Sure.
It happens. You mentioned all the big plays that they had throughout the season. So you can have, you know, 2 timeouts left after a minute 45 and effectively run your offense. I mean, it's not like they were pinned back at the Chiefs 15 or anything. It was average field position. I don't know where it was in particular.
I don't remember exactly.
I don't know. We'll say somewhere between the 20 and the 35 probably.
Just fine.
Which is average. Enough time to drive downfield. And then, yeah, it makes no sense why the Chiefs decide to call a timeout on second down. They were looking too hot at the end. I mean, they got their touchdown at the end of the first quarter. In the second quarter, they really didn't do a whole heck of a lot. But that clock management, I think, plays into the whole grander scheme of clock management and time possession throughout the whole game. I said last week that the Niners had the ball over half the time during the regular season. The Chiefs had it under half the time. In this game, the Niners had the ball 26 minutes and 47 seconds to the Chiefs 33 minutes and 13 seconds.
Interesting.
So essentially, 6.5 more minutes the Chiefs had the ball than the Niners, when traditionally throughout the whole season, it was reversed. So if you can't get the ball more than half the time, you can't really use the running scheme that you want to use, and the Niners couldn't use it. ESPN has like a win probability thing they have, where basically throughout the whole course of the four quarters, it like charts a graph on what the percentage chance of each team to win is. You know, it goes up and down based on who scores. At the 7:26 mark in the fourth quarter, the Niners had a 95.3% chance to win it. And then at 6:13 left, the Chiefs scored a touchdown. And then 2:44, they scored another. And then at 1:12, they scored again. Every time they got the ball back, they just moved it faster and faster and faster downfield. And the Niners didn't have anything to say about it. If you're breeding your team on this strong defense and time of possession and running the ball, how are you going to let a Chiefs team do what you guys do better than you guys?
Right. And I mean, you said it, the Chiefs in every playoff game this postseason came from behind. It was the same story for them every time. But despite that, if you're the 49ers, that's probably exactly where you want to be, right? You've got 7 minutes left
Absolutely.
In the game. You're up by two scores, and you base your game on defense and running the football. I mean, that's time of possession. That's, even if you let the Chiefs score, make them do it slowly. What times did you say? 6-something, 2-something,
the
and
first
1-something?
Touchdown. So the first touchdown they scored at 6:13. That was a 2-minute, 40-second drive. So they got the ball back under 9 minutes to go. They got the ball essentially at 9 minutes to start their drive. The next drive they scored in about 2.5 minutes, and that was under 3 minutes to go. So the Niners only had the ball. I think they went 3 and out between those two touchdown drives. There was nothing to be had there. And then their final touchdown drive, it was quick 13 seconds. It was basically one dud play, and then Damian Williams shot up the field for 38 yards. And that's the way it went.
See, and it's a tricky spot to be in, because if you're the 49ers, you want to play that kill the clock game. You want to run it. You want to play to your strengths. You want to play on defensive bend, don't break type of style. Let them march down the field. Let them score a touchdown. That's fine, because you have some wiggle room, and then your offense takes over the ball again and can continue to kill some clock. But when you try to do that and you don't do that, it's hard to flip that switch back, especially when you've been playing that type of game really all fourth quarter. And they didn't have any answers.
And they needed Garoppolo to make passes. They needed big plays to be had, big catches to be made, and they weren't there. He threw interceptions. Kendall Fuller should have had another interception in the fourth. He had a great jump on a ball. I think at this point the Chiefs were ahead, but he jumped the route perfectly, just didn't catch it. And Tom Brady, for years, you know, love him, hate him, most likely hate him. He knows how to get the job done in crunch time. If he has the lead, he's not giving up. Look, last year it was 13-3. The Rams really didn't threaten, and Brady was able to run the offense effectively enough. Yes, their defense was the main course of the reason why they won, but still, he didn't help them lose. Jimmy G didn't, though.
But yeah, you can make that same argument for this year's 49ers team. They made their living on their defense, and they had a 10-point lead late in the game, and they weren't able to hold on to it. And they have a very good defensive coordinator, too.
You know, oh, yeah, Robert Saleh should be ahead. No. Yeah, I'm sorry. You say what you want to say about him, then I have 2 points to make.
Well, no, I was just going to say that it's not, I mean, to blame poor coaching, I don't even think is the right answer, because I think he's a really good defensive coordinator, and they have really good guys on that defense. It's interesting the way that it happened. It really comes down to the Chiefs, just their offense being too much, and that speaks to why the Chiefs are the Super Bowl champions.
So I think I said last week, whatever, about Robert Saleh not having any sort of, or a few weeks ago, whenever we were talking about all the coaches and stuff, that he should have been hired somewhere. He's a very good defensive coordinator, top five in the game right now. I mean, he took a Niners team that was 4-12 last year with, you know, a bunch of new moving pieces, cohesively brought them together, formed a great team. I mean, their pass rush, excellent. He's not a coach anywhere. Another guy who's not a coach anywhere is the Chiefs offensive coordinator, Eric Bieniemy. Now, you may credit a lot of the offensive success to Patrick Mahomes, which I think is a fair point to make, but this guy is really just revolutionizing their offense really well. They've never been a run-first team. Damian Williams looks like he's a very high-caliber starting running back with the way their offensive coordinator uses him in the system. He didn't receive any coaching offers either, and I don't get it. Just wait till the Super Bowl. Wait till the best guys possibly available can get hired by a guy. Why do you need to jump right into it in the second week of January? I mean, effectively now, most NFL teams and players are going to take 1, 2, maybe even 3 months off. which is fine. That's what the offseason's for. I just don't know why you have to jump right into it so fast. I mean, like you said about Matt Rhule getting that 7-year deal was ridiculous. Well, how about two guys that have been proven in the league, can show they can win at a high level, not getting the attention they deserve? I don't know. It's weird to me.
It's good for both of those teams, though. Certainly increases their chances of being back next year.
One last question. Who has the better chance? Just between, you have to pick one. Kansas City or San Francisco, who has the best chance of making it back again next season? You can factor in whatever you want, but
it's interesting.
Who has the best chance?
Well, I saw an article that kind of talks about the 49ers and how their path is a little bit more difficult in terms of some of the guys that they have to try to find room to re-sign. We talked last week, I think, on the show about the cap space that they have when we were talking about their general manager and how good of a job he did. I think it was $15 million, give or take.
A lot of wiggle room.
But certainly, if you've got guys coming off of rookie deals that need to be re-signed or guys that are just in general looking for a raise, that certainly becomes more difficult. And, I mean, if they lose pieces on that defense, it's going to be tough. I do still like that team. Man, I would probably say the Chiefs, and I think I would say the Chiefs for two reasons. One, Patrick Mahomes, because obviously he's one of the most dynamic players in the NFL. Second, and most importantly, the AFC is not as strong as the NFC. In the AFC, you've got a Patriots team that is sort of on the decline, a Ravens team that probably will not be able to keep up exactly what they did this year. 14-2, best rushing team in NFL history, is not going to be repeated next year.
It won't.
And as far as up and coming teams, I see more teams in the AFC up and coming from like the basement to wild card potential, yes, as opposed to wild card to top of the conference champions.
Exactly.
So to me, the Chiefs seem like the team that has the easier path back just for that reason.
Yeah, I agree with you, mainly for that reason. I mean, the Ravens, I think, will be very good next year.
Yeah,
they will be strong competition. I want to say the Steelers will be good next year. I'm not confident yet, but I feel like they will give teams more trouble than they did this season.
Yeah.
Patriots, I don't know. They're going to be good enough.
I think they're on the way out.
The thing is, I think the Chiefs might have figured them out, though. I mean, they figured them out with Tom Brady and all the tools they had this year. Next year, they're looking more questionable. And then you look at the NFC side, the Niners, their division's good. The Rams will be better this year. The Seahawks are still good. I think the Cardinals will be better this year, too. They're getting there.
I think it's a slower climb, but yeah, you're right.
They're getting there.
No easy wins necessarily in that division.
Still a Packers, still the Saints. Ideally, the Cowboys. I think they've turned
Should
it around.
Should be the Cowboys, yeah.
The Chiefs' path is so much easier in the AFC. And, I mean, clearly they were the better team this season, so you would like to take your chances against them with them, too. Whereas the Niners, a lot more questions around them.
Yeah, and, I mean, I think one big thing with the Chiefs is, I mean, I've been critical of them on defense, but they found a way to play solid defensively throughout the regular season late and then into the playoffs. But they got over the hump. Patrick Mahomes has been there now. He's won a game, whether he deserved to be the MVP or not. He won a Super Bowl. Andy Reid finally gets that monkey off his back. He can say that as a head coach, he won a Super Bowl. And so I think that makes things a little bit easier for them as well. All those obstacles, whether they're real or just in people's heads, that, well, they have to get past the Patriots. Well, Andy Reid hasn't won a Super Bowl. Patrick Mahomes hasn't been there yet. That's all gone. That's all been taken care of. And so I think there aren't any more psychological obstacles for them to overcome, and I don't know that there are many physical obstacles for them to overcome in the AFC.
Kansas City is relishing in their second victory in the Super Bowl. Well-deserved, and a great season capped off by their victory. We have more NFL to talk about, though. That's not the entire end. We have to give the rundown on all the awards that were won. We made our predictions. Was that last week, 2 weeks ago?
Last week.
Last week, yeah. Yeah, we were pretty good on them. Lamar Jackson, unanimous MVP, second all-time. Only Tom Brady was the only other unanimous. Well-deserved, I think. Coach of the Year went to John Harbaugh. I didn't pick him, but I don't see this being a bad pick. I just didn't say him because I don't like him. But I'm not a writer, so that's fine. Offensive Player of the Year, I said Michael Thomas. You had McCaffrey. Thomas was the one who ended up coming on top, but
I said it on the show. I don't think that there's a right or wrong
answer
between those two, as long as it was one of those two guys.
I'm going to save controversial for last. Nick Bosa, the Defensive Rookie of the Year. That was kind of that was a runaway.
Easy.
Ryan Tannehill, Comeback Player of the Year.
I think that's the perfect choice.
Yeah, you liked him a lot.
Love that one.
I think it's a good one, too. I was going more injury-based. Offensive Rookie of the Year, Kyler Murray.
Hate that one. I don't like it.
There were people who... So it's a problem. There's a lot of quarterback-centric awards that overlook the individual performances of other people. Did you say Josh Jacobs too?
Yeah, we both did.
Running back for the Raiders. Excellent individual season. A.J. Brown also up there. Yes, the Cardinals were better. Yes, Kyler Murray was fine. But, I mean...
Not the best offensive rookie.
No. I mean, he was fine. He was fine enough. I think there's a lot of promise to him. But this isn't the most promise award. This is the who was the best in their first season in the NFL award. And I don't think Murray was that guy.
No.
And then defensive player of the year. Boy, oh boy, this is an interesting one. Stephon Gilmore, cornerback of the Patriots. He had a very good season. I would say best defensive back, maybe. But
up there. Top three, definitely.
I had Chandler Jones. He finished second. You had TJ Watt. He finished third. Should have been a lot closer than it was. I think it was the whole stigma of, oh, yeah, the Patriots defense built around Gilmore. He's making all these big plays. I mean, he had a good season. He had a lot of interceptions and stuff, but he wasn't exactly the terror on the field that Jones or Watt were. And I guess the writers saw otherwise.
Realistically, TJ Watt at third, I think, makes sense. I didn't think he was going to win. I think third is about where I would have expected him to slot in, even though I think he should have been higher than that. Chandler Jones, I think I didn't expect to get that much credit. You kind of talked about him being underrated.
Yeah, I think the writers see him a lot better than the media does.
Well, and that's a good thing, because the numbers you gave last week certainly back up the case that he should be in that conversation. But no, I agree. Gilmore did not surprise me. It seemed like everything I read suggested that it would be him, suggested that he was the front runner. But
media bias.
I just don't think that that should have been. Like I said, there were other defensive backs that had similar stat
Steven
lines.
Steven Nelson was good.
Yeah.
Tre'Davious White from the Bills.
That would probably be the next guy up there, yeah.
Even Sherman had a pretty good year. A lot of guys did, but whatever. Either way, that's the wrap-up on the 2019-2020 NFL season. But there's still more NFL to talk about, Matt, because the Hall of Fame members got inducted. Do you want me to rattle off all the old guys, or you got to take
some?
No, something?
Go ahead.
All right, I'm going to take care of all the guys that maybe some people that aren't our age would know. I know Coach Jimmy Johnson, former Cowboys coach. So the Hall of Fame for the 100 years, let me preface, Centennial class, they have like a special, essentially old school class where they inducted a bunch of guys that are no longer on the modern day ballot. Well, like, I don't know, 15 guys, something like that.
There's a lot of guys.
Two coaches, Jimmy Johnson from the Cowboys, well-deserving. Bill Cowher from the Steelers, obviously we think he's very well-deserving. Those two guys definitely deserved it. Former president Steve Sable, he worked with NFL Films too. He was a great guy. Commissioner Paul Tagliabue, he was commissioner for like 20-some years. He was great, saw a lot of expansion and growth in the league. All right, then here's a bunch of guys I'm not going to know, and that's just the way it's going to be. GM George Young, wide receiver Harold Carmichael, offensive tackle Jim Covert, safety Bobby Dillon, safety Cliff Harris, offensive tackle Winston Hill, defensive tackle Alex Karras, safety Donnie Shell, former Steeler, played on the 70s Super Bowl teams. The only reason I know him because of that. Offensive tackle Duke Slater. I looked up this guy. He was an end, Max Speedy. Technically tight end is what we call it now, but it was kind of receive slash run slash tight end at that time. It was like the 50s with the Browns. I don't know. Black and white. They won championships with him, so he's fine. Edge rusher, Ed Sprinkle. He sprinkled in some sacks, I guess. Those are all the old guys. Any of those stand out?
Actually, I thought the old guys, like the really old school guys, were kind of fun to look at. Ed Sprinkle, you mentioned. He's listed as defensive line, linebacker, and end.
Yeah, that's why I said edge.
Yeah, it's just kind of funny that, you know, back in the day, you've got these guys playing every position, NFL champion, back before we had the Super Bowl. Max Speedy, four-time AAFC champion and a one-time NFL champion. So he played long enough ago that we were even before NFL championships, which is kind of cool. Duke Slater, you mentioned the offensive lineman, played from 1922 to 1931. First African-American offensive lineman, played for the Milwaukee Badgers, the Rock Island Independents, and the Chicago Cardinals, which is kind of cool. I like that kind of history stuff, so that's kind of unique. Everybody else makes a little more sense in terms of the NFL as we know it now. Lots of Super Bowls among these guys. The general manager that you mentioned was from the Giants, two-time Super Bowl champion, five-time executive of the year. So very good at what he did for the New York Giants.
He had a good track record, sure.
I mean, all these guys obviously were very good at what they did and certainly deserved to be in. I think it's kind of a cool thing that they did here. Largest class ever for the Hall of Fame. A lot of guys.
A lot of guys.
But it's kind of cool to get a little glimpse of the NFL's history in this class.
And we didn't even mention the modern-day guys that got
in. No, not yet.
So we got five new ones from the modern-day era, people that we've actually seen.
Yes.
We can speak about them. First, I'm going to start with a guy I never saw play, Steve Atwater, safety. He played for the Broncos back in the 90s when they were winning Super Bowls and doing good things. So obviously he was good. Receiver Isaac Bruce played for the St. Louis Rams, was on their Super Bowl team. Excellent receiver. Him and Torrey Holt, I believe.
Maybe, sure.
I'm going to look that up real quick. Bruce was a very good receiver for the Rams for a while. play of Kurt Warner, played for a number of years. Offensive guard Steve Hutchinson split time between the Seahawks and the Vikings. Really good offensive guard, but not the best one in the class. But he's the one that got in, which is unfortunate. Should have been Alan Faneca from the Steelers, who once again is omitted. He's a seven-time All-Pro, and we're going to throw in Steve Hutchinson over him. Okay. Running back Edgerrin James, really instrumental with those Colts teams with Peyton Manning, was the good fallback he had for a number of years. Moved to the Cardinals after the Colts, still had a very good career. And first ballot, hometown guy, safety Troy Polamalu, well-deserving for him to get into.
Yeah, a lot of these guys I can't say I know too much about. Isaac Bruce, you mentioned with the Rams, over 1,000 receptions in his career, over 15,000 yards, 91 touchdowns in a Super Bowl. Doesn't get a whole lot more complete than that for a resume. James, two-time rushing champion. I believe they were his first two seasons in the league. I think I saw he was the only player to have ever done that, or the first player to have ever done that. So very impressive there for him. And of course, Troy Polamalu, I mean, we can both speak to him more than we can speak to these other guys because we saw him play
a terror on the field
here in Pittsburgh for a long time. 2010 Defensive Player of the Year. I feel like that kind of gets overshadowed sometimes.
Must have lost Super Bowl that year.
Yeah, and I feel like even James Harrison winning Defensive Player of the Year, I think gets more traction than Polamalu winning it. I think Polamalu is remembered for just his overall style of play more so than he is for specific stats or accolades, but he's a two-time champion. He played in three Super Bowls with the Steelers, did win that Defensive Player of the Year. Obviously, the pick six against, was it
the Ravens,
in the conference championship game? Yep.
09.
And I mean, just such a unique player. Again, I can't speak to the other guys as well as I can speak to Troy Polamalu, but a one-of-a-kind player, and you're never going to see a guy like him again. So I more than deserving, obviously, to be in this class. And cool that he gets to go in with head coach Bill Cowher.
I'll speak about Isaac Bruce. Eight seasons of over 1,000 yards receiving. Played from 94 to 2009.
Wow.
Barely missed time. 98 he missed most of the year. In 2009, he missed most of the year. But 05, he missed five games most of the time. Like from 99 to 2004, he missed one game as a receiver. Had almost 1,000 yards each season. He led the league in receiving in 96, too. Really all-around great guy. He's Edgerrin James, rushing champions, whatever. Steve Hutchinson, he was fine. I mean, he was the blocker for Sean Alexander, then Adrian Peterson. So
Seven straight Pro Bowls for him at one point in his career.
Not that he's a bad offensive guard. Yeah. I think Faneca's the better. He blocked for Bettis and a bunch of other random running backs that wouldn't have had success otherwise if not for his good blocking. But he's not undeserving. It's just someone's more deserving. Whatever. These five guys, they're fine. They're in. It is what it is. Congrats to them. Congrats to all the old school guys. A lot of them probably never thought they'd get that call. Here they are finally getting it in 2020. So big credit to all those guys. But there's still more football, Matt.
Oh, is there really?
There is.
Yeah, there is.
It's not
AAF?
NFL. Ah, what the heck is that? I think it's defunct.
Yeah.
NFL?
Very long.
College.
The XFL.
The XFL.
Back. It's back, Chris. Vince McMahon going for round two with the XFL, putting a lot of money into this thing.
A lot.
I already am a little bit more, okay, well, I was more excited about the AAF last year than I am about the XFL, but I'm more confident in the XFL.
Because a better business model there.
Yes, we saw the AAF come together very quickly. It was exciting, but it was not sustainable because of how quickly it was put together. There wasn't the finances to back it. It just didn't work. The XFL has been in the works, I believe, longer than the AAF.
Yes, they announced it before.
So in the time that the AAF decided it was going to be a thing, played part of its regular season, and then had to fold, the XFL has just kind of been in the background waiting to strike, and it is now finally their time. They will begin play this weekend. They're kind of keeping things modest, which I like. They are
not
expecting,
as showy as last time.
Right. They're expecting 10,000 to 12,000 fans per game for opening weekend, which in a 60,000, 70,000 seat stadium is a pretty modest expectation. And I think that that's fine. And I think that that's a good way to look at this. They have some interesting things going on. Football Advisory Network is a group of fans that they have volunteering as a sounding board type of thing.
Football Advisory Network, FAN?
Yep, that's exactly what the direction that they're going with.
I like that.
But anyway, it's a board that kind of gives feedback on rules, presentation, fan experience, broadcast, things of that nature. So kind of a cool thing that they have there to sort of keep them in check, I guess, from a fan perspective early on. because the biggest thing I think that they're focusing on from what I've read is the eye test. They're not worried about the money right away so much because, one, they have more money invested in it already. They have a more secure plan. And Vince McMahon's got more money than he knows what to do with.
That's why he's doing FXFL again.
Yeah, so he can certainly afford to back them up. But the key for them is the eye test, and that's making sure that when fans see it for the first time, it's worth coming back to see a second time. And so the focus right now is making sure that the experience and the football itself meet the standards of football fans in America so that this can continue for that reason. So part of what they're doing is access. Their access is intended to be inclusive, intended to be affordable. Apparently, league-wide, you should be able to get four lower bowl tickets for $100 or less, which is pretty good. And
it's like seeing a Pirates game.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. And it's a good way to get fans involved. Pre-game tailgates, fans on the field pre-game and post-game, behind-the-scenes interviews, halftime speeches by the head coach, I think, are going to be seen in the stadium and in the broadcast. So they have a lot of things going on. Interviews mid-game, I believe, as well. Extra players mic'd up, trying to humanize the players. So it's a very, very inclusive, fan-oriented setup right now.
That reminds me, the first XFL in the championship game, it was bad. It was like 40-6 or something. It was bad football. A big reason why it stopped, but the losing team was, they were bad. They weren't good. The quarterback like threw an interception or whatever, and then they interviewed him right on the sideline immediately, and it was weird because he was like, oh, well, you know, didn't throw a good ball there or whatever, and I think that's the last pass that guy ever threw or something.
And it kind of sounds like they're going to be similar to that, but maybe not necessarily right after that type of a play. Maybe after a touchdown or after your team takes the ball away or something like that. We'll see how that plays out. But kind of cool, sort of like the AAF in the way that they gave us some behind-the-scenes type of deal. I would like to see if they'll do the transparent replays like the AAF did. I thought that was one of the better features of the AAF.
They do have the Sky Judge.
Okay, which was also a good feature of the
AAF. The official
that's
up in the box to check out things. I got a few more rules here.
Yeah, go for it.
So it's essentially American football as we know it, with some twists to make it basically just more entertaining, more exciting, more fast-paced. There's no extra point. You can try a one-point play from the two, a two-point play from the five, or a three-point play from the 10.
I love that. I think that's cool. I think that's exciting.
They need offense to get more eyes. There's a 25-second play clock, which the NFL has a 40-second play clock, so just got to get to the line faster or whatever. There's a running game clock, just speeds up the whole game in general. You can have a double forward pass as long as the ball does not cross the line of scrimmage. So you can snap it back 10 yards, throw it forward 5. As long as you're not past the line of scrimmage, you can still throw it forward again.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know that that'll come in handy all that often.
Maybe just on bum screen plays. Yeah. I mean, you could essentially set up a forward screen from the shotgun that goes downfield.
But
I don't know. You know, these guys don't exactly have the skill for that as well as NFL. Only need 1 foot inbounds for a catch, so that's what we see in high school and college. NFL requires 2, so more receptions, more action, more yards that way. And overtime is something out of a video game. It's 5 rounds from the 5-yard line. You get 1 play from the 5. Each play is worth 2 points if you score it, and it goes up to 5 rounds. And it mathematically, if like a team scores on the first 3 possessions, the other team doesn't, well, then overtime's over at that point. But
like PKs, like a shootout.
It's a lot like NHL. Shootout is exactly what they're comparing it to. So those are the most important changes. I mean, there's some stuff with the refereeing and whatever. I think they have like an extra official in general. I think they got 9 guys on the field
or whatever. They have a designated ball spotter to make sure that the 25-second play clock, obviously they're trying to speed things up, making sure that things move efficiently. To go along with that, halftime is 10 minutes. So, sure. Again, their goal is to keep games under 3 hours.
What is NFL, 15?
Probably 15.
College is like 20 and NFL is like 15, right?
Yeah, so we're going 10 to try to cut that down again. Just to be clear, you talked about the extra point options. Kicking is not an option. So you have these different plays to go for 1, 2, or 3, whatever.
There's kickoff ones too.
Yes, but you cannot kick an extra point. There is no extra point kicking. And yeah, go ahead with the kickoff rules.
Do you have them written down?
I do.
Yeah, you speak them written down because they're just in my mind right now.
So it's a little bit confusing. The kicker will kick off from the 25-yard line.
NFL's 35.
The coverage team will be at the 35-yard line, and the return team will be at the 30-yard line. The rule is that they can't move until the kick returner touches the ball or the ball has been on the ground for 3 seconds. I'm very interested to see how that plays out.
How do you coach that?
I don't know.
I don't.
I have no idea. Who's counting 3 seconds before they move? And like, that's move at all, right? Is that how you heard that too?
I would assume probably just move from the line of scrimmage. Yeah, I mean, it's probably like a false start, similar.
It's interesting.
And also, do you have about the touchbacks too?
I do not.
So if the ball goes into the end zone, I think they get it back at the 10. If the ball is like, what was it? If it's like lands inside the 25 or inside the 20 or whatever, they get it at like the 35. So essentially, they want you to kick it somewhere that the team will return the ball. And if you're the return team, you don't want it to go in the end zone because you will be in bad position. They want there to be action on the kickoffs. That's what they want.
But the idea, I think, of the not moving right away and the way that's set up is that it's still safer than like an NFL kickoff. And I think that's where that's kind of, they want the excitement of the kickoff without the danger that has kind of deterred the NFL from encouraging people to return kicks.
And on punting, there's no gunners like just rushing towards the punter either. That's kind of the more, all right, we'll just get the action. We're not going to go for like the kill each other mentality, which the XFL kind of went for a lot before.
They certainly seem to have their head on their shoulders a little bit more this time in terms of what the actual football looks like. And I think that that's going to make them more successful.
The teams, there's 4 in each division. You got Dallas, Houston, LA, and Seattle in the West. In the East, you got DC, New York, St. Louis, and Tampa Bay. I got a list of some guys that stand out to me. I'll start with the Steelers, though, because those are obviously ones that we're all going to know. Landry Jones is the starting quarterback for the Dallas Renegades under former Oklahoma coach Bob Stoops. They worked together back when Landry was in college. Stoops is a national champion at Oklahoma. He's a very good coach, probably the biggest name on the coaching / playing field. Sammy Coates, he's a receiver on the Houston Roughnecks, used to be a bum on the Steelers. Eli Rogers, receiver for DC, pretty good on the Steelers. Wish he had came back last year. It's okay. Dorton Grant was a cornerback we drafted who never did anything. And Shamarco Thomas was a safety. All 3 of those guys are on DC. Matt McCrane was our kicker last year against the Bengals in Week 17. He's the kicker for New York. Yeah, that's about it. I mean, I got some other guys on here. Aaron Murray used to be quarterback at Georgia. Cardell Jones, big guy at Ohio State's on DC. Josh Johnson was in the AAF, then was on the Redskins last year. Now he's with LA. Dallas Renegades also have 2 good running backs. Cameron Artis Payne was on the Panthers for a number of years behind Jonathan Stewart. Lance Dunbar rushed for ever on the Cowboys. I don't think he was ever the starter there, but he was there for like 6 years. So there's some real people, not a lot, but enough.
Yeah, I think you hit on most of the big ones. Some of the other ones I had for the LA Wildcats, running back Elijah Wood is a name that I've heard before in the NFL. We'll see what he's able to do. Kicker Nick Novak
is
just everywhere.
He's been everywhere.
AAF, NFL, he's just everywhere. He's in LA now for the XFL. The Battlehawks really don't seem to have a lot. Safety Will Hill is the only name that
King, punter for the Raiders.
Oh, okay, there you go. Yeah, so
Will Hill's been around, though.
I will say, though, when one of your most notable players is a punter, things may not be looking great, but we'll see. It's hard to really judge any of these teams right now. Let's see, who else? The Roughnecks, you mentioned Sammy Coates. Defensive end Coney Ealy is a name that I recognize from the NFL. Don't know that he played a whole lot in terms of starting games and in terms of loss of seasons, but I think he racked up a number of sacks throughout his career. Quarterback Connor Cook is also there, I believe, formerly of Michigan State. Yeah, the New York Guardians at quarterback, Luis Perez, who we know from the AAF last year. Played pretty well with Birmingham, if I remember correctly. And then Matt McGloin, former Raiders quarterback and Penn State quarterback prior to that.
Taylor Henneke, quarterback for the Panthers. He was on St. Louis now. Was on the Panthers, I believe. BJ Daniels was really good at USF. That's the only reason I know him. He's on Seattle. Keenan Reynolds is like the leading quarterback rusher in NCAA. He was with Navy at that time. He's a receiver now on Seattle.
Yes.
Once again, we know more than any reasonable person should, but there's enough names that you'll be like, oh, him.
It's a little bit different, I think, than the AAF. I think when the AAF came out and we looked at rosters, I think it was safe to say that there were more names there that we knew. So I don't know if it's people are more skeptical or what the case may be, and these guys might turn out to be just as good, if not better, but there are more names that I don't know, that you don't know, that America won't know. But I think that's part of what is going to make it exciting, the fact that we don't know these guys and we don't know what to expect. And just because the Battle Hawks don't have many people that I've heard of before doesn't mean that the Battle Hawks are going to be a bad football team in the XFL. So it's exciting that everybody's kind of starting on the same page and that we get to learn some new names and experience this together. So I'm excited. I think it's going to be cool. I hope it goes better than the AAF did, because at least get through your first season.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm really hoping that they get beyond that, but obviously the AAF in terms of completion did not set the bar very high. No. But we'll see if they take some components of the AAF, if they take some things from the NFL and tweak them a little bit. And maybe the NFL takes some things from the XFL. It's going to be an interesting dynamic. I'm excited to see how it turns out, and I hope it's better than what we saw last year at this time.
Ideally, starting this weekend, we will have 10 straight regular season weeks followed by 2 postseason weeks of XFL action. Still, a lot to be had with that, but man, there's been a lot of football to talk about. I'm gassed. I'm sure you are too from listening to us. So let's take a break for a little bit, and we'll come back stronger than ever for some good trade talk finally.
Welcome back to the show, Sports Takeover. Matt and Chris here on RMU Radio. And Chris, last week, asked for some trades, and we have some trades. Let's start in Major League Baseball with one that I don't think you were asking for.
I wasn't.
Mookie Betts is on his way out of Boston and into Los Angeles, shaking up all of Major League Baseball. The AL gets shaken up by the departure of Betts. The NL gets shaken up by the addition of Betts. Obviously, other dominoes had to fall to make this happen. Just incredible. I mean, Mookie Betts, a World Series champion, obviously with the Red Sox in 2018.
MVP.
Having one of the best seasons we've ever seen, I think, in Major League Baseball, one of the most complete seasons. And now here, last offseason at this time, we would have been talking about how fantastic of a player he was and how much money he earned in arbitration that he very much deserved. And now we're talking about him switching colors and switching coasts and switching leagues and everything. Go ahead.
Is this the biggest person we've seen traded probably since...
I'd say
the MLB hasn't seen a trade this large since Alex Rodriguez got traded.
Probably.
It's.
I mean, this guy lit Major League Baseball on fire last year en route to a World Series.
He's a top five player in general.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's a Gold Glove winner on defense, a Silver Slugger, an MVP, a guy you want on your team. He's good. He's liked by many. He's right on the same tier as Mike Trout. He just needs more seasons of this excellence to be on the same exact level as him. He's fantastic. He is deserving of all the money. Give him a check like the Yankees gave Garrett Cole and say, all right, Mookie, you tell me how much you're worth and I'll give it to you because that's how good he is. And Boston said, well, I don't think we have the money for you. So they sent Mookie Betts and David Price to the Dodgers. They retained half of Price's salary. In exchange, Boston received outfielder Alex Verdugo from the Dodgers, a very good prospect. He's going to be a good starting outfielder. That's a fact. And they also got pitcher Brusdar Graterol. Yeah, that's a name you never heard, and I never heard either. And they got him from the Twins. Well, why are the Twins involved in this? Well, because money needs to be thrown around more by the Dodgers, because the Twins received pitcher Kenton Maeda, who is also a very good pitcher, shores up their bullpen, which was probably their weakest point of their team. So good for the Twins. Boston sheds a whole lot of money. They get a good outfield prospect in Verdugo, who's going to be starting for their team probably for at least 5 to 10 years, as long as he doesn't get moved. This Brusdar guy is a really good prospect, too. He's a pitcher. I think he was pretty high. Do you have a number on where he was?
I do not.
He's a good prospect. He's one that you want to trade for, not just one you say, oh, you have a bag of peanuts for him. No, he's a good one. And the Dodgers turn into I think most people probably have them winning the division. I think most people have them winning the World Series. It's that big of a trade. David Price is a former Cy Young winner. Mookie Betts is a former MVP. The Dodgers already had two of those guys in their team. Two outfielders now have MVPs on the Dodgers roster, Betts and Bellinger. Two starting pitchers now have Cy Youngs, Price and Kershaw. There's no weakness on this team.
No, and I mean, this is a team that obviously did not make the World Series this year as the Nationals won it, but the prior 2 years they did, and they came up short. And for a team like that, there aren't that many moves that you're going to make that are going to get you over the hump.
No.
Because getting over the hump is winning a game or two extra at the end of the season against the best team in baseball. And that's just not, you know, that's not just trying to get out of the first round. But this kind of a move is the type of move that would do that. I mean, you're taking a very good team, one of the best teams in baseball for the last number of years, and you're actually adding to it. And that's just not an easy thing to do. And they've done it. Obviously, David Price is not necessarily in his prime.
But I think he's still good.
He is absolutely still good.
I think he's better than his number
helped
seven.
Helped them win a World Series in 2018. I mean, he's not... Both of these guys very not far removed from excellence as a team and as individuals. And for Boston, such a weird turn of events. I mean, again, at this time last year, we were talking about the defending World Series champions, and now they've lost their MVP, one of their best pitchers. They've lost their manager. They've got the whole Astros scandal somewhat hanging over them as well, in an already very competitive division that they missed out on last year. I mean, things are not in good shape for Boston. Things are in very good shape for LA, and for the Dodgers in that NL West, the Diamondbacks have been making some moves this offseason. So certainly that keeps the Dodgers maybe a couple steps ahead of them. So not only does it help them get to where they need to get to, but it also keeps them a step ahead of the rest of the division. The most simple part of all of this is the Minnesota Twins getting Kenta Maeda, like you said. Obviously, they have no issues with the bats.
No, that's
with
easy.
As many home runs as they hit last year, and they added Josh Donaldson as well in the offseason. So they've got that covered. Adding Kenta Maeda certainly helps on the other side of the ball. looks very good for Minnesota. I think they definitely got a good portion of this trade.
But there's still more, because the Dodgers had Jock Peterson in their outfield, and they had Cody Bellinger, and they have Chris Taylor, and they have Kike Hernandez, and they say, we want Mookie Betts. One of you has to go, but don't worry, Jock. You can keep your residence. We're just going to ship it to the AL, as Jock Peterson is now on the Los Angeles Angels alongside outfield prospect Andy Pages. I don't know. I have nothing to say about him. Pitcher Ross Stripling, too, got thrown into the deal today, who is teetered between good starter and good bullpen. I think if he gets a starting chance with the Angels, he can be a very proven starter. In exchange, the Dodgers get Luis Rengifo. He's a shortstop. And two other prospects to be named later. So that was more of a salary slash position jump, which is fine. They don't need Peterson if they have Betts. They have Taylor and Hernandez on their bench now, and they would start on majority of MLB rosters. This Dodgers team was the best team in the NL each of the last three seasons. Who can
now stop? They have Mookie Betts.
You can't do more. If they don't win this year, they're not going to win.
We had this conversation earlier today. This should be their year, and if this is not their year, they might not have a year.
They might not. And Betts only has a one-year deal left in this arbitration, and there's a lot of money to be thrown around to those Dodger players. And I don't know if there's going to be money for Betts, but if they get a ring this year, I don't think they care about that, and I don't think they should. They came so close 2 years ago. They very well could have beat the Astros. Who knows what would have happened if it wasn't.
What could have been, yeah.
Yeah, if it could have been against the Yankees. Who knows? They very well could have beaten... They couldn't have beaten the Red Sox. Red Sox were a machine that year. But Alex Cora was there, and you don't know how much the bat and bang and stuff was involved with that. It has to be their time. It has to.
It certainly should be.
Either way, big move for them. And there's more trade news to talk about. And it's not in baseball.
This is more like what you were asking for.
And it's not in hockey. It's in basketball. And my goodness, there are more moving parts than I can count. A dozen. 12, count them, between four different teams. Just shifting everything around. The biggest move was the Atlanta Hawks received center Clint Capela and center Nene, is not important, from the Rockets. Clint Capela is averaging a double-double this year, about 13 rebounds, 13 points. He just signed a 5-year deal this year off of his rookie contract. He's a very good center. He will be a very good center for a while. Houston got Robert Covington, Jordan Bell, and the Warriors second round back. The Minnesota Timberwolves, they threw their hat into the ring here. They're the ones that shipped off Covington. They got shooting guard Malik Beasley, power forward Juancho Hernan Gomez, power forward Jared Vanderbilt, and shooting guard Evan Turner, and the Hawks' first-round pick. And the Denver Nuggets got point guard Shabazz Napier, small forward Keita Bates-Diop, shooting guard Gerald Green, power forward Noah Vonleh, and Houston's first round. Now, there's a lot of stuff that happened. Minnesota just got some guys to shore up a terrible team already. They just think these guys will be better in the future. It's fine. They're not competing this year. There was not really a spot for Capela in the Rockets lineup. They were 10-1 in the season without him in the lineup, which is weird.
It's interesting.
They won the other night without having a player taller than 6'8" play. That's the first time since, like, 63 that happened. P.J. Tucker is playing the 5 right now, and he is a power forward, barely. He's a small forward. Playing power, now playing the 5. They're going small ball. But most importantly, Clint Capela to the Hawks is what you got to worry about here. It gives Trae Young someone to actually compete with. The Hawks are bad this year.
The Hawks are horrible. This gives them something to cling to, I suppose.
I mean, Capella's young. Trae Young is also very young. In 6 years, maybe. It's kind of like we talked about with Oklahoma City. Yeah, they shipped off all these good players. But boy, just wait till we see what they got in store for them.
Playing a little bit of the long game here, and I think that's okay for Houston. I think it's an interesting trade. I didn't realize that they were 10-1 without Capela in the lineup. That certainly makes him more movable than I thought he was originally. And of course, the draft picks going back and forth too. Who'd you say got Golden State's second rounder?
Houston did for some reason.
That honestly isn't bad with as bad as Golden State is.
It's not. Well, okay. I'm sorry. It's their 2024 second round pick. Was on some other team from some other point. I don't know. Whatever her position that Golden State finishes in 2024 will be Houston's. I assume it was from some other trade made in the past or whatever.
Well, even that Atlanta pick that goes to Minnesota, I believe, is from Brooklyn, which is kind of disappointing. There were recent years where a pick from Brooklyn meant very good things.
Meant a lottery pick.
This year, I think it would have been better to have come from Atlanta, but it doesn't. It's via Brooklyn.
And this Houston pick that Denver receives will probably be around the same position that Denver picks anyway, probably somewhere in the 20s,
probably
I would imagine.
For,
so. And it's really hard to gauge NBA talent past the first 15. And I've read I was reading about this. A lot of people don't think this draft is particularly thick, which I would agree with. You got three, four guys maybe at the top and not a whole lot in the first round. So if Houston thinks this is what they need now, then good. It also frees up $12 million in cap space for Houston for them to potentially flip something to another center, because the trade deadline is not here yet. It's coming this week, but it's not quite there yet. So I don't think they're entirely done yet.
No, and I mean, another move could be all it takes. With as tight as the standings are in both conferences right now, that extra move can make the difference for Houston.
But this is the exact kind of trade nonsense hullabaloo that we needed. What's better than waking up and seeing four teams and 12 different pieces moving all around? All these players are like, well, wait, where'd you come from? Where'd you come from? It's great. It's madness, but it's great.
One other move, Andre Iguodala. Has not played in Memphis. I like Andre Iguodala. I enjoyed him watching him with the Warriors. I don't know what his issue is with not playing in Memphis. Memphis finally is moving on from him, sending him to the Miami Heat, where he assigned a two-year, $30 million contract, where he will play, and going the other way is Justice Winslow. So obviously for Memphis, this is a good trade because
it's good for both teams.
You're letting go of a guy that apparently, for whatever reason, had no interest in playing for you. So anything you get back in return, literally anything, is a win. Justice Winslow's a fine player. That'll work just fine. For Miami, obviously, Andre Iguodala, champion with Golden State Warriors, very good defensive
big
player.
Big veteran presence.
That's the kind of move that'll make a difference for that team that's tight in a battle in the Eastern Conference. I think, like you said, good trade both ways.
And Memphis is actually the 8 in the West. I don't think that's going to matter in the long run, but you never know. And I mean, Winslow is a nice young guy that gives Morant somebody else to work with. And like you said, Iggy wasn't playing at all with Memphis this
literally
year.
Literally anything. Is
I read an article earlier. He's been in San Francisco with some tech company doing I don't even know what. But he's going to lace him up for the Heat, though.
I don't get it.
And make a postseason push.
Was.
I don't know either.
Whatever. It's over. He's
good
gone.
Trades. Hopefully we got more for you next week. I love talking about trades this time of year because it's always just wild picks and players going left and right. Just NHL, throw your hat in the ring, please.
Speaking of wild picks, it's quick picks time,
that
Chris.
Is.
Let's start in the NHL. Penguins and Lightning, they've got a home and home coming up in the next week. I'm going to go with a split. These are two teams at the top.
You love your splits.
Well, I mean, look, they're both playing really good hockey right now. The odds, I think, of but one of them losing twice is pretty slim, so I'm going to go with a split. And it was right last week, so.
Yeah. Well, it was right last week. My pick of the team, the Flames, I said, would take both last week. I'm going to go with the Lightning taking both this week.
Oh.
They only have one more loss than the Penguins do. They're carbon copies of each other. Lightning have been playing very well recently. They've surged. Nice Lightning joke for you. And they're playing really great. Penguins, they looked okay this past weekend. Kind of looked terrible in the third period against the Caps. Don't want to see that against the Lightning. Lightning are really good. It'll be good games, I hope, but I have the Lightning in both of these. Central Division, kind of important, but not really, seeing how St. Louis is far ahead. They host the Dallas Stars. I got the Blues. No reason.
I have the Blues as well. They're a good home team. The Stars don't score very much. Jordan Binnington will probably make it more difficult for them to score in general. So I'll go with the Blues as well. Flames at Canucks. I'm going to go with the Canucks. They're 7-2-1 in their last 10. Calgary's got a negative 19 goal differential in the season. A little bit blown out of proportion by empty net goals and whatnot. But certainly they don't seem to have what the Canucks have. So I'm going with Vancouver.
They will have less than 19 goal differential following this game because I got the Flames taking this one. It's a very tight race in the Pacific. The Battle of Alberta last week between them and Edmonton was crazy. Fights all over the place. The Flames are fighting for their lives honestly at this point. Canucks are doing well. I like the Flames, though. Flyers at Islanders in the why are these two teams competitive? But oh my goodness, they are in the Metro. I'm going with the Flyers in this one. I just don't feel good about the Islanders. I haven't all season. I still don't. I'm sure I'll be wrong. I felt good about the Flyers this year. I'm going to go with them in this one.
I have the Flyers as well. 7-2-1 in their last 10.
I like the Canucks.
Islanders are only 4-3-3 in their last 10. They don't score as well as the Flyers do, so I'll go with Philadelphia. Into the NBA, Heat at Clippers. I'm going to go with the Clippers. They're 8-2 in their last 10, 21-5 at home. Miami, obviously, we just talked about adding Andre Iguodala, but I still think they'll fall to the Clippers.
Yeah, Miami's about 500 on the road. They cannot defeat the Clippers, who are the better team in general, but especially on the road. I have LA. Pacers at Raptors. The Raptors won 11 in a row. Nobody's talking about it. We're going to start talking about it because they're going to make it at least 12 in a row with this Pacer victory here. Yes, the Pacers got back Victor Oladipo, but the Raptors have just a very good team, built so solidly, just as good as they were last year, even without Kawhi. I like him in this one.
11 wins in a row for them. Indiana, 13 and 12 on the road. I'll take the Raptors as well. College basketball, number 8, Florida State at number 7, Duke. I'm going to go with the Seminoles. They were the team that I said would be the next new number 1. Well, this would certainly be a good game to help get them to that spot. So why not? I'll go with Florida State.
I'll pick Duke in this one. They have already lost a few games in the ACC that they probably shouldn't have. I don't think they're going to have another one here. On to bowl predictions. I will begin in Major League Baseball. We talked about the Dodgers. They made so many good deals. Surely they're going to win the World Series. I'm not saying that, though. I will say 110 wins in the regular season, well within their grasp. The modern-day record was 116 set by the Mariners in 2001. The Yankees had 114, I think, in 97 or 98. And maybe they'll contend with that. Maybe 111 and 51 will be where they find themselves. Either way, 110 seems well within the realm of reason for them.
It's a lot of wins. I'm going to go on the opposite of both of those things. The Boston Red Sox, who obviously let go of Mookie Betts, will not finish better than fourth in the American League East. I wanted to say last, but the Orioles do still live in that division.
Behind the Blue Jays.
Yes, behind the Blue Jays.
All right.
Behind the Yankees, behind the Rays.
So yeah, those two make sense.
I think those teams are good enough. We talked about the Blue Jays have made some moves, enough I think to be better than a Boston team that's lost Betts, Price, Cora. It's a tough time in Boston.
On to the NHL for my second one. Playoff picture. There's a lot of teams, 16 of them in it right now. Some teams on the outside looking in. I think 14 of the 16 teams that we see right now will be in the playoffs whenever we talk about our playoff preview. Only two teams will be shifting around. Could be Chicago, could be Winnipeg, could be Nashville. They might find themselves in, could be Toronto finding themselves in. As it currently stands, though, only two teams in a playoff position will fall out by the end of the season.
Interesting. I'll go to the NFL. We talked about some awards, the MVP award. I'm going to say in 2020, the MVP will not be awarded to a quarterback. It would be the first time since Adrian Peterson won it in 2012. I just think, you know, we talked about Offensive Player of the Year and some of the defensive guys that were out there. There are a lot of good guys out there having a lot of good seasons, and I think one of them will stand out next year more than any quarterback.
Terrell Edmonds?
Maybe not him.
I like to see someone else, but as a quarterback, it's boring. Speaking of quarterbacks, though, the Chargers have a vacancy at quarterback. Phillip Rivers, he's done. They have the 6th overall pick. They have sunny California. Tom Brady likes California. Tom Brady to the Chargers. They draft Justin Herbert with the 6th overall pick to sit behind him. It's a lot.
Interesting.
It's a lot. It makes sense to me, though.
That's a good one. I like that one.
If Herbert falls to 6, they take him. There's been talks that the Dolphins might want him, that Tua might fall to 6. But picking 6, there's a few good quarterbacks. Bryce Love. Joe Burrow's probably going to go first, but Bryce Love's around. You got Tua. You got Herbert. They have a need for quarterback. Tom Brady could bridge the gap and lead Herbert to success.
No love for Tyrod, I suppose, out in Los Angeles. No, that's fine.
More than they have for him.
To the XFL, because why not? I'll pick my champion right now.
Oh, my goodness.
I know nothing about these teams, Chris. Nobody knows anything about these teams. I'm going to go with the Dallas Renegades. You and I have talked about this. You wanted to pick Dallas in our weekly pick'em, and you like them overall as well.
Landry.
Because of Landry, and that was why I didn't want to pick them. However, the connection that he has with Coach Bob Stoops is a connection that I don't think anybody else in the XFL is going to have. Those guys were together all through Landry's college career. They had success there. Landry did not do well in Pittsburgh. However, this is not Pittsburgh. This is not the NFL. He's back with Bob Stoops, and I think that'll mean good things for the Dallas Renegades. I have nothing to back that up, just those two. So that's why not? That's the fun.
You've got a 12.5% chance picking whoever you want.
It's fair.
To be fair, on Athlon Sports, they did their preseason power rankings for the XFL, and Dallas was at number 1.
Well, there we go. That settles it then.
That settles it, and that settles the show.
Yes, that's all the time that we have for tonight. Thanks to everybody for tuning in, as always. For Chris over on the other side of the table, we'll see you next time.